Can mindfulness help surgeons avoid burnout?
Mortality among American professional football and baseball players.
What are the causes of death domestically around pregnancy?
And the Heart Association's recommendations for treating cholesterol.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on May 31st, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'd like to turn to JAMA Network Open first, one that I said before we started recording, I bet you sort of rolled your eyes at this one, but clearly it's one that also speaks to my practices, actually, and also some of my proclivities. That was the use of mindfulness meditation in surgical trainees with the intention of reducing the amount of stress that they felt and ultimately in burnout. Very small study, the N21, 38% women, and they were randomized to either this modified mindfulness-based stress reduction arm or to a control arm. In the control arm, there were only 9 people. And they took a look at, we're going to teach you these techniques and get you to practice those, and let's see what this does with regard to a number of metrics over different time points. And they looked at working memory, cognitive control, that is, can we hang on to our emotions when we're confronted with different things? A couple of other metrics. The other thing that they wanted to have people develop was conscious awareness of their cognitive control process, what they call metacognition, which I think is sort of an interesting term. So they followed these folks, they employed this, and they had some interesting things happen. One postgraduate year one surgical resident actually came to the wrong session and ended up having to cross over to the other arm. Basically, what they showed was that it was helpful for them to engage in these practices, although for some of the metrics, it started to decline in its efficacy as time went on. And to me, that suggests that maybe some additional booster, if you will, or some other technique to try to help them to maintain these practices might be helpful over the long haul.
I wasn't as enthusiastic about this study. It's a pilot study, and it does show that the mindfulness techniques are feasible and acceptable. And there was a modest benefit in terms of stress reduction and improved executive function. But the major thing they were trying to do is to prevent burnout. And even though there was some improvement in these, what I'm going to call surrogate measures, there really wasn't any decrease in the amount of burnout experienced among these first-year surgical residents. Now, again, it could be because it's such a small study and they couldn't see it, or it could be that, in fact, these surrogate measures really aren't good ways of preventing burnout.
Yeah. To me, though, it's pretty persuasive to teach people these kinds of skills so that they can at least be aware of how they're feeling.
It is. The other thing that was interesting about the study you didn't mention is they actually examined brain regions to see if the mindfulness would change the activation when they exposed individuals to stress. And in fact, it did show that there was difference in activity in the brain, and particularly increased enhanced activity in certain areas of the brain that are known to be able to help people deal with stress. So that was a way they had a very objective brain imaging to support what they found in one of the softer psychologic studies.
Well, I at least will welcome expansion of this particular type of intervention and maybe the addition of other techniques to help people get their arms around it.
It may be that additional techniques may be helpful, or may just be that the effects wane no matter what you do.
That was a pessimistic thought. Let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine. You picked this one, Cholesterol Management Guidelines.
I know you rolled your eyes at this because we talk a lot about a cholesterol treatment, but heart disease is still the leading cause of death in the United States among whites, among African Americans, among Hispanics, and both for men and women. And we know that one of the major risk factors for that is high cholesterol. So the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association looked at their 2013 guidelines and then updated them based upon some randomized control trials. And they recommend the following, and I'll just try to summarize. One is that a heart-healthy lifestyle is still the foundation of lowering cholesterol. Individuals that have had a major cardiovascular event and multiple other high-risk conditions should be on a high-dose statin. And if their LDL cholesterol doesn't get below 70, they should add a second non-statin agent. Other individuals should be on statin if your LDL is over 190, if you're age 40 to 75 and you have diabetes, and if your 10-year risk of cardiovascular disease is over 20%, those individuals should be on a statin. And then consideration if their LDL cholesterol doesn't get low enough to adding a non-statin therapy. Now, what about people in the intermediate range? Well, those are individuals that you need to have a discussion with and see if they have other risk factors, like a history of premature coronary disease in the family, or chronic kidney disease, or premature menopause, or an inflammatory disease, or a high-risk ethnic group like South Asians, or elevated triglyceride levels. Those individuals should probably be on a statin. And lastly, you can use coronary calcium scoring, and those individuals that have a high coronary calcium score should also be on statin therapy.
And to me, sounds like this is yet one more, shall we call it an expansion, or the inclusion of many more folks who really ought to be on a statin. And I've quipped at many points in the past, gosh, are we going to put these things in the water?
One wouldn't advocate giving it to individuals that don't receive a benefit. That is, if their risk is less than 5%, or if they don't have known cardiovascular disease. But the evidence is pretty clear that for individuals that are at high risk or do have cardiovascular disease, that lowering cholesterol improves long-term survival.
And I'm hoping that we're going to kind of have nailed this one down and not visit it too often again in the future. Let's turn to Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. This was a look at pregnancy-related complications and death, actually, pregnancy-related mortality ratios in the U.S. And it turns out I was sort of surprised by this number because it seemed kind of small to me, but 700 women on average die from pregnancy-related complications every year. So they looked at the data from 2011 to 2015, and they were able to determine that non-Hispanic Black women and American Indian or Alaska Native women had the highest risk of pregnancy-related mortality. Actually, it was 3.3 and 2.5 times as high as for non-Hispanic white women. The timing of the death was known for almost 90% of these folks. About a third occurred during pregnancy, about 17% on the day of delivery, about 19% 1 to 6 days postpartum, and the others further out. Their leading causes of pregnancy-related deaths were determined to be preventable and did not differ significantly by race or ethnicity or timing of death in approximately 60% of these cases. So to me, this sounds like a place where, wow, could we prevent this? 60% of these deaths could be prevented. It sounds like we need a little more awareness here.
They delved a little bit further and said, okay, we know that these deaths occur from pregnancy all the way up to a year afterwards, and the causes of death are different with regard to the timing. For example, on the day of delivery, hemorrhage and amniotic fluid embolism is the most likely cause. 1 to 6 days postpartum, it's hemorrhage and hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. For a week to 6 weeks afterwards, it's more commonly due to infection and cardiovascular disease. And then from about 6 weeks to 1 year afterwards, it's almost always cardiovascular disease. So knowing this can help target the different causes of death. And as you mentioned, 60% of these are estimated to be preventable.
So good news then in that we can identify these and intervene appropriately. Let's turn to your final one. We're talking about, speaking of death, among National Football League athletes and Major League Baseball athletes. That's in JAMA Network Open.
There's been some suggestion that American-style football players have a lower overall mortality compared to the general population, but possibly with increased neurodegenerative mortality. However, when you compare athletes to the general population, this can introduce bias because athletes, by definition of what they are, should be healthier because they exercise and are involved in training programs. So a more appropriate comparison is to look at two different types of athletes. Hence, this study looking at mortality among American professional football players and American baseball players. So they examined former National Football League and Major League Baseball players who played at least five seasons between 1959 and 1988 and had died between 1979 and 2013 in the United States. And what they observed is that there was an increase in all-cause cardiovascular disease and neurodegenerative disease among American-style football players than among former professional baseball players. All-cause death was about 26% higher in football players, cardiovascular disease about 2.5-fold higher, and neurodegenerative disease about 3-fold higher.
What do you think about this? I thought it was really interesting and informative that they chose other professional athletes as the comparison group. So that was a good thing. What do you think about these causes of death in these folks?
Well, Elizabeth, it's interesting that cardiovascular disease is about 2.5-fold higher. And it may have to do with the body habitus and that football players are generally bigger and it increases the risk of metabolic disease. The neurodegenerative disease was somewhat interesting. It was more likely due to Parkinson's disease and there wasn't an increase in Alzheimer's or dementia. Now, again, these were data gleaned from players that played decades ago. We know that rules have changed. Helmets are safer. On the other hand, football players are bigger as well. So it'd be interesting to see whether this carries over in more recent data. But there's no doubt that American football players have a higher mortality than American baseball players. And by the way, they die at a younger age. They die on the average of 60 years of age, whereas the baseball players died an average of 67 years of age.
Yep, definitely something that needs to be followed. I'm not sure it's going to dissuade anyone from playing professional football, but I think being on the lookout for some of these problems is a good idea.
Certainly, if football players know that the risk of death from cardiovascular disease is 2.5-fold higher than other athletes, they need to address the risk factors. Obesity, metabolic factors, hypertension, cigarette smoking, and cholesterol.
On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.